Well, like Gabe said, we're back in 1 Corinthians. So go ahead and grab your Bibles there and turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It's going to be the sort of last time we're going to be in 1 Corinthians just for a few weeks. I think next couple weeks, Luke's going to be teaching for us, I believe, out of the book of Philippians, but good to round out, finish out this section that we've been in. So 1 Corinthians 10, I just want to finish out this first couple paragraphs. We have covered verses 1 through 11. We've just got really verses 12 and 13, maybe a couple of the most significant or well-known verses in this section. I'll read them for us in a second. You'll know what I'm talking about, but we're going to finish out this section, just a shorter passage, just two verses tonight, so a little bit of a shorter study. So 1 Corinthians 10, verses 12 and 13. Of course, you remember we're in this section that where Paul is talking about and addressing the issue of Christian liberties. He began that back in chapter 8, and for them, it raised the issue that raised this topic was the matter of eating meat sacrificed to idols. Of course, back then, you remember, we've said it in our review just about every Friday that we've been in the section there. There in Corinth, we're being rescued out of a pagan culture, all kinds of pagan worshipers, and their conscience was burdened by the idolatry and the revelry that they were saved out of, and they associated the meat sacrificed to the idols with that idol worship, and so it bothered some of their consciences to eat that meat again. It reminded them of their sinful life prior to coming to Christ, and so Paul's wanting them to just be careful, not that eating or drinking anything in particular is in and of itself sinful, which is what makes it a liberty, right? A freedom. But that Paul is just wanting them to take care with the use of their liberties, particularly who they exercise their liberties around and the kind of sway that it has on their hearts and the reasons why they might partake or not partake. I mean, that's what's important. You know, we talked about how they're, you know, just to translate it to our time today, you know, there are a lot of decisions that we as Christians make that aren't explicitly prohibited or encouraged in the Bible. And yet, we still have to be careful about how we make those decisions, right? Our motive still matters. And just because something isn't prohibited explicitly in the Scriptures doesn't mean that, hey, that's all I need to know and I'm free to partake of it, right? Anything, Paul's making the point here, especially in chapter 10, can become an idol for us, even good things, right? And so Paul begins to warn the Corinthians about how they're handling their Christian liberties. And he starts in chapters 8 and 9 by, if you remember, warning them against how their particular practice of their liberties needs to take into consideration other people, right? Love for other people, whether it's going to cause another weaker brother to stumble if they were to observe them partaking of this liberty. So we have to exercise our liberties still out of love for other people. So that ought to sort of at least put some boundaries, give us some parameters as to how we're to function and use those things. But he moves on, and not only that, he gets into chapter 9, he starts to talk about, well, there are some liberties that we might take and partake of that would actually hinder our gospel usefulness and our ministry, right? I mean, look, if we were just here in living life here on earth, grasping for every enjoyment and entertainment that we're free to enjoy, that would at some point hinder our ability or get in the way of our ability to maximize our usefulness for the sake of gospel ministry in this life. And so that was chapter 9. So he says, hey, be careful that your pursuit of your liberties isn't detracting from or prohibiting you from being used by the Lord in ways that you could otherwise be used if you just disciplined and streamlined your life and got rid of some of those things. So by the time we get to chapter 10, all this is just review of the context, you know, because we weren't here last week. We had our Q&A or our small groups. But by the time you get to chapter 10, Paul's now transitioning. Hey, not only is ought to your decisions about liberties, how you use them, consider others and consider your own ministry. It also, you ought to also consider how your liberties might be a danger to your own soul. And that's where we're talking, that's what we're talking about in chapter 10. And it's probably the most significant warning that Paul now lands on. Because he's saying, look, not only can your use of liberties cause others to stumble, it might actually be a stumbling block for your own heart as well. Right? If those liberties begin to become idolatries, right? In other words, if they are no longer, hey, I'm free to partake of this, take it or leave it, but now it becomes something that I have to have and I have to enjoy at the expense of other people, you know, liberties can easily become that, can't they? So Paul's warning us, and he warns us particularly by pointing to, you remember, the example of the nation of Israel. That's how he starts this whole chapter, verses 1 through 11. He says, hey, you don't think that your liberties can become idolatry and therefore actually lead you into destructive patterns and ultimately have you in a place where you're being judged by God? You mean all that just that began all the way up here and how I use my liberties? You don't think that can happen? Well, just look at the nation of Israel, right? And so in the past couple of Fridays, we've looked in verses 1 through 11. We've tried to draw out some of these lessons to learn about how liberties can become idolatries. From verses 1 through 11, and we tried, just to review, we drew out three lessons from those verses, if you remember, three lessons from God's dealings with Israel about the danger of our liberties becoming idolatries. Lesson number one, you remember, came to us in verses 1 through 5, and that was that idolatry is always a danger. Even for the privileged, right? That our privilege, even our spiritual privilege and position, does not protect us or guard us from that danger. You remember verses 1 through 5? You know, Paul says, look, Israel was so privileged. They had provision from God, protection, direction. They had the pre-incarnate Christ following them around in the wilderness, supplying all that they needed in miraculous ways. They had been rescued from Egypt. God parted the Red Sea for them. They walked across on dry land, and they were constituted a people for His own possession. And yet, the very next moment we read of, they're grumbling, they're complaining, and they're God was, verse 5, not well pleased, and they were laid low in the wilderness. They had so much spiritual privilege, and yet that didn't keep them from allowing these things to become idolatries. It didn't guard them. So idolatry is always a danger, even in the face of spiritual privilege. But the second lesson, well, second and third, we learned a couple weeks ago. Second lesson was verses 6 and 7, you remember, and that's idolatry always begins as a lust. That's what we learned from verses 6 and 7. You remember Paul says, hey, look, Let's learn from their example. And the very explicit lesson he wants us to learn is this, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. That's the problem with idolatry. Idolatry is at its very core, and in the very beginning, it's always an issue of our lusts. It always begins that way, right? It always begins as this desire to enjoy something, to have something, right? Maybe it's marriage, right? And you're saying, well, that's a good thing, isn't it? Well, yeah. But if we're not careful, that good desire can become a controlling desire and become an idolatrous desire when it begins to control us, when it goes from, hey, it'd be nice to have, trust the Lord with that, to I'm lusting after it. It's now a craving. And that's a problem. That's where all idolatry begins. And that's what we learned, verses 6 and 7. And then lastly, you remember, we looked at verses 8 through 10. And the lesson there was that while idolatry begins as a lust, it always ends in judgment. It always ends in judgment. And Paul there lists all these scenarios of Israel in the wilderness and what happened to them. And not a one of those scenarios turns out well. And he says, these things, verse 11, happened to them as an example. And they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. In other words, guys, we have so much revelation teaching us these lessons. May we learn them. Paul's warning here is to learn from Israel so that our liberties don't become idolatries. Now, by the time you get to verses 12 and 13, Paul, notice here now, is going to draw his logical conclusion now from this history lesson, right? He's going to say, okay, here's my main point then. And he's going to finally, when he gets to verse 12, apply all of this to us in one massive warning, and we'll categorize it this way, against pride, the pride of presumption. What do we mean by that? That's what these two verses have everything to do with, pride. Paul is, after all of that, saying very pointedly, look, here's what I want you to learn. I want you to learn not to be proud, because that will make you vulnerable to temptation. If you want to guard against, listen, if you want to learn from Israel, here's the core problem. And it was the problem in Corinth too. I mean, we've seen that over and over again in the book as we've studied it. Pride is such a gangrene, and it will, here's where it becomes so practical for us, okay? Not just if you're trying to guard against the temptation from turning your liberty into an idolatry. Yeah, that's the context. But what's so practical and helpful about these two verses is it shows us and it connects for us so tightly here, the issue of pride and our failures when we fall into sin. You guys ever thought about that connection? You know, let's just back out and just in general, okay, and just talk about sin and temptation in general. I mean, look, this is so basic to the Christian life. Your sanctification is all about resisting temptation, resisting sin, right? The question is tonight, how do you do that successfully? I mean, why do you fail, right? That's the question. Why do I keep giving in to this particular sin. Like when I run up against temptation, when I'm all of a sudden assaulted, when the flaming arrows of the evil one are in the air, and I've seen them before, and you're saying, look, and I keep falling, I keep failing. What gives? What's the issue? Have you ever diagnosed the issue as pride? Paul does. He does right here. You see, he says, look, notice in the context, he says, if you don't think that you're susceptible to this danger, I mean, especially, particularly the context of turning your liberties into idolatries, but we can apply this to any sin, right? If you don't think you're susceptible to falling, to failing in any particular sin, if you imagine that you're somehow immune, then you're probably closer to falling than you realize. That's probably part of your problem. Notice verses 12 and 13. We'll read it. Paul is warning against spiritual pride here. Notice he says, he gets to verse 12 and he says, here's the issue. Therefore, right? In light of Israel's lesson, history lesson, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Just two short verses tonight, I think they're going to be so practical, and I want you just to tie this connection so tightly in your mind so that you can learn to battle sin in with more effectiveness, okay? The problem Paul points to here in our failures when we give in to temptation is pride. It's our overconfidence as we live the Christian life. Haven't you seen that before? Like, haven't you experienced that oftentimes in the Christian life, the ups and downs? You know, you get a little bit of victory in an area, and then all of a sudden it's sort of starting to puff you up a little bit, and then what happens? You get complacent, you get smug, and it's like, and all around the corner comes the same temptation, you're like, boom. And you seem to be blindsided, and you're like, what happened? I thought I was done with this. And Paul's saying, look, here's part of the problem. Let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. So we need to learn here. Maybe you've heard of the proverbial saying before, the very biblical saying before, that pride always goes before what? Pride always goes before the fall. You've heard that. You know, it's a biblical idea. It's based on Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. Proverbs 16:18. So that's a very biblical sentiment. That is exactly what Paul is talking about here. In fact, that's what I titled, Ben. This is a title for tonight. Pride goes before the fall. And this is exactly what we're going to learn tonight from these verses. There's a connection Paul is drawing. There's a direct line he's drawing between our ability to successfully stand firm against temptation and our own pride and presumption or humility. There's a line there that Paul is drawing. Pride is the Achilles heel in your battle against sin and temptation. In fact, I would even argue, as you read this and you think about this, it won't matter how much you know about a topic or a particular sin or about how to battle a particular sin. It won't actually matter how much theology you know about that or how many Bible verses you've necessarily memorized against that sin. It won't matter how familiar you are with redemptive history so as not to repeat the same mistakes that Israel did. It won't matter how gifted you are, how much you serve in the church. It won't matter. None of those things will matter. It won't matter how long you've gone without committing that sin if you allow pride to creep into your heart. And you begin to think more highly of yourself than you ought to, Romans 12:3. As soon as that happens, listen, you are vulnerable, Paul says. That is just a biblical fact. You're about as close to falling as you'll ever be when pride bubbles up in your heart, when it gets a foothold. And here in these two verses, Paul is explicitly warning the Corinthians that even though they've not set out, you remember we said this multiple times in this section, even though they haven't set out intentionally to commit the serious sin of idolatry, right? Whoever does. Like, they didn't start their day thinking, that'll be a good idea. Paul's warning them, look, you'll fall prey to that serious sin if you continue to allow pride to fester in your heart. So, what we have in these two verses is Paul's corrective counsel on this issue to the Corinthians. He's taking their pride head on because that's what makes them vulnerable. And so what I want to do is draw from these two verses two major reasons why pride makes us more vulnerable to falling into temptation and sin. We need to understand this. There's two reasons why pride makes us vulnerable to failure. Moral failure, really. I'll give them to you both here. They're really simple. Number one, verse 12, because pride makes us careless. Pride makes us careless. Number two, because pride makes excuses, verse 13. Pride makes us careless and pride makes excuses. We'll have to explain the second one a little bit more. It's not as intuitive to us, depending on how you've read verse 13 in the past. That's a little hint. But so let's consider verse 12 first, how pride makes us vulnerable to temptation and sin because it makes us careless. It makes us careless. Notice verse 12, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. Now, this one's pretty straightforward. You think about it. Paul's main command and warning here is for a particular kind of person. Did you notice? It's a present tense command, meaning it's to be an ongoing action. This is something that has to happen continually. It's always an issue. You've always got to stay on top of this. But specifically, for who? Notice, it's for him who thinks he stands. Is that you? The verb here for thinks is the word that is sometimes translated suppose. It is a word that refers to someone's subjective opinion about something. It reminds us of someone that Paul had already addressed. Flip back to chapter 8 for a moment. The beginning of chapter 8, beginning of this whole section concerning meat sacrificed to idols, you remember, Paul starts by saying verses 1 and 2, he's addressing the proud Corinthians who think they know, but they don't really know. Now, concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Notice, knowledge makes arrogant. There's pride. There's the issue again. But love edifies. Here's, look at verse 2. Here's our word. If anyone supposes, if anyone thinks, if it's anyone's opinion that he knows anything, that he has this superior knowledge, and that makes them safe, right? He has not yet known as he ought to know. You see the indictment there? It's the same. Back to chapter 10 here. This is the proud person, the one who has this high view of himself because he knows a lot. One writer says, their presumed knowledge has led them to risk idolatrous associations and to think nothing of it. Look, knowledge is certainly not a problem, but it could be a liability if you trust in your knowledge, right? Like if you're the one who says, look, we of all people should know this at Twin City Bible Church, we do in some ways appreciate the fact that we learn deep theology here and we sit for hours on end listening to preaching, binge watching MacArthur videos, right? Like, you know, we have a seminary here. All of that is great, but there could be a problem if we begin to imagine, if we begin to think, if we begin to suppose that having that alone is the safeguard for our souls. And Paul is saying, look, you better be careful. But notice in our context here, look at verse 12 again. What is it here specifically that this person thinks or supposes? Back in chapter 8 was he thinks he has knowledge. He supposes that he knows, but he doesn't really know. What is it here that he thinks? What is this guy's opinion of himself here? Notice, this person thinks what? You can answer. He thinks he stands. Not just he thinks he knows, but here he actually thinks he stands. Or he supposes, he imagines, it's his personal opinion of himself that he is standing, that he is established, and he will continue to stand. That nothing can assail him from where he is. What does it mean to stand? Well, you know, if you survey the scriptures, I'll read a few cross-references here for you just to give you an idea, a smattering. So, but you can write them down. Don't turn there. Just listen. Luke 21, verse 36. Jesus says to his disciples, but keep on the alert at all times. So kind of the same warning here, right? Be careful. Praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man, to be established, to be proven, to persevere to the end. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11, sort of famous armor of God section, it's the same word when Paul commands us to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. In other words, to stand against the schemes of the devil is to resist temptation. It is to successfully thwart Satan's schemes, right? It's a posture of victory is what it is. Jude 24, the very end, we love to read, not now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling here and to make you stand in the presence of his glory, blameless and with great joy, right? So that's enough. To give you an idea, to stand then in all these ways means to successfully resist temptation and sin, to persevere, to stand strong, to stand firm, and to one day therefore stand before God established in victory, having not fallen away, having not compromised, having not given in to sin and temptation. Here, in 10 verse 12, it shows up in the perfect tense, which usually indicates a past completed action. For example, when Jesus said on the cross, tetelestai, right, it is finished. It's really, it has been finished. He uses this tense there to indicate that his work was completed and there is nothing more and nothing left for him to do. That's the idea here. So put all those things together. Think about it. Think about what is it that this guy thinks about himself. He actually supposes that his standing is a done deal. I mean, how arrogant, right? Think about it. He supposes, he imagines, he thinks that the victory is already his and there's nothing left for him to do, that he's secure, that he's safe, that he's going to persevere, that he doesn't have to be careful, right? He imagines that he's already arrived, that his safety and his security from the sin is not an issue. The danger of falling is long past and done away with. That's this guy. You see the problem here? He is self-confident of his position. That's who Paul's talking to. And Paul says, look, his warning and his command here to that guy, the one who is that proud, the one who is so self-assured and self-confident, is be careful. Now, Paul doesn't explicitly say here why this person thinks or supposes that their victory is guaranteed. He doesn't tell us why this guy is so confident. But we could at least ask the question. I mean, have you ever been there before? Are there times when you think you're past the danger of certain sins? Has that ever been the case for you? Why do you think that in those moments? Just sort of take some inventory. What is it that makes you imagine that you're not susceptible anymore or you're not vulnerable still? What convinces you in those moments that, hey, I can kind of let my guard down, I can take it easy here. Look, after all, fill in the blank. What is that? Is it because, again, because I haven't sinned in that way for 4 months? Is it because, hey, I read like 5 books on that sin, and the Wednesday night series over the summer soul tune-up, you know, that they did, you know, really hammered that, and I was convicted, and, you know, I'm good to go. I got that. What is it? I mean, think about it. There are all kinds of reasons. I don't know why, but none of them are valid, right? Paul is saying, look, it doesn't matter how you get there. It's still proud. It doesn't matter. I mean, at the end of the day, how could you be so proud to say, oh, I'm done. I have this in the bag. Whatever the reason is for your overconfidence, notice, it clearly makes you lazy. It makes you careless. Pride makes you vulnerable because pride makes you careless. It makes you careless and complacent about the danger that is lurking. It robs you of that attitude that Paul actually says here keeps you away from danger. It robs you of the very means that Paul says God has determined to keep you safe. The command here, notice, is take heed. It's watch out. For that person, be careful. Beware. It's a command of spiritual urgency to be vigilant, to be alert, to be attentive, to be on guard. And it is this carefulness that actually protects us and keeps us from falling. That's it. That's what God has determined to use, right? He says, look, if you want to be safe, then be careful. Charles Hodge, Princeton theologian, he writes this in his commentary, no degree of progress we may have already made, no amount of privileges which we may have enjoyed can justify the lack of caution. Listen, beloved, proud people are careless. because they are overconfident and they underestimate and they miscalculate the real danger that they're actually in. And they actually put themselves in greater danger when that's their attitude. Listen, this is so true. Peter teaches this as well. Peter makes this link also. Listen to 1 Peter 5. You younger men, verse 8, or verse 5, likewise be subject to your elders. Listen to this. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility. Why? For God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Don't be proud, right? That he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. Listen to this. And here's the result. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. You see, Peter knew that humility would make you careful and pride would make you careless and you'd be gobbled up by the adversary in no time. Christian, you have to battle pride like it is the devil, because it is. Pride is the ultimate spiritual sleeping agent. It's the worst kind of spiritual sedative. It will trick you into thinking that you don't have to take care. Satan loves the sleepy Christian. It's why Satan loves to puff Christians up in pride. Because if you can be tempted towards pride, then you can be tempted towards anything, idolatry included. That's the lesson we learn here, right? So Paul's warning here is against pride because it makes us vulnerable, because it makes us careless. Is that true of you? Are you careless around certain sins or any sin or sin in general? I mean, are you overconfident? Are you careless? Have you rolled your eyes at the thought that your liberties could become idolatries? Have you heard this series of warning after warning of be careful with how you use your liberties and say, that'll never happen to me. I mean, I'm in control of this thing. I got it. Is that you? Have you imagined that, sure, maybe that can happen to other people, not me? Paul's talking to you here in verse 12. So we need to be careful of that. We need to understand that pride makes us careless. That's why it's problematic. So troubleshoot your failure next time. You know, is it because you were careless? You became proud and you became careless. You dropped your guard. You know, I think of those. You know, have you ever watched boxers in the ring? You know what happens when they start to get proud? You know, are their hands up by their face anymore guarding? No, they're all like doing this thing, like, you know, taunting the other person. It's like, hit me in the face, come on. And then they get knocked out. It's like, well, you deserve it. Like that's what we do sometimes. Still be careless. But secondly, notice verse 13. Now, pride makes us vulnerable to falling into temptation because it makes excuses. Not only does it make us careless, it makes excuses. Now, this is going to need some more explaining because of how probably some of us have read this verse before, but we'll just read it again. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Now, I know this is maybe a familiar verse that we often use to comfort ourselves and others with about, you know, the faith, again, the faithfulness of God to help us in our temptations. But notice, I want you to just notice something here. Did you notice? Let's not be bumper sticker Christians, okay? Notice in this context how verse 12 is a warning. And verse 14 is a warning. Therefore, beloved, flee from idolatry. He just got done saying, hey, don't be complacent, don't be proud, don't be presumptuous, don't be overconfident. Take heed lest you fall. And he's going to say, so flee. Don't stick around. Don't grow comfortable. And this verse is right in between that. So what do we make of that context? It's a little strange how this encouraging verse 13 fits in between two warnings against complacency, isn't it? Because initially, I think even myself, we may read it and interpret it as Paul simply saying, hey, don't worry about your temptation. It's pretty normal. God's going to take care of you, right? That's how we have sometimes read verse 13. But when you understand that Paul is actually writing verse 13 between two warnings for us to be careful and to take sin seriously, it begins to read a little differently. Did you notice? Here's how you should actually read this verse if you're reading it in context. Here's how you should read it. You have no excuse if you fall into temptation because, one, your temptation is not uniquely different than all the other temptations that people have faced. And two, because God has supplied you with everything you need to resist it. Do you see what he's doing there? I mean, that is encouraging, but it's also indicting, isn't it, when you fall and when you fail? It comes on the heels of this warning, hey, be careful, take heed. You have no excuse if you fail. Paul writes verse 13, yes, as an encouragement, but first and foremost as a warning. It is a warning to the proud person who always makes excuses and blame shifts all day long about their sin. You know people like that? You know what? They're usually the people who are super overconfident in the beginning, aren't they? Oh, that'll never happen to me. And then the next week you see them, and it's like, well, so did it happen? Yeah, but, you know, temptation was too difficult. You know, it just was, whoa, it was crazy. It like came out of nowhere. I don't know what happened. And, oh, by the way, you know, I don't think the Lord didn't really help me here. You met people like that before? Always making excuses, always blame shifting. Paul says that is pride. Pride comes before, listen, and after the fall. Notice first here how Paul seeks to correct and confront the kind of pride that tends, first, it tends to blame our circumstances for our moral failures. That's what this person does a lot, right? Notice, here he corrects that, though. He says, look, no temptation's overtaken you but such as is common to man. You can't put it on your circumstances. You can't say, man, I just, no one has ever experienced what I just experienced before. You can't say that. Paul rips this excuse right out of our mouths, right out from underneath our feet. The excuse that says this, and we've all done it, listen, the situation was just too difficult, is so uniquely tailored, so it was so unbearable, it was irresistible, it was insurmountable, it was as if it was the perfect storm. It was tailor-made, tailor-fit to get me at the right time and just to catch me right there. And I just fell. I mean, what is Paul's answer to that? Listen, literally, a temptation has not overtaken you, is how you should read this. A temptation has not overtaken you. In other words, whatever trying or tempting circumstance you're experiencing or facing, be assured it has not grabbed you, which is what this verb means. It's not singled you out. It's not selected you. It's not seized upon you. It's not taken you into its grip. Notice, except what is common to man. That's what tripped you up. You should have known it. You should have seen it. this is normal stuff. This is everyday Christianity. What happened? But the phrase common to man here translates a single adjective. It describes that which is merely human. In other words, Paul's describing our circumstances as the normal kind that all people face. They're not extraordinary. They're not superhuman. They're not unique. They're not new. They're not. They're just run-of-the-mill mankind stuff that we deal with. Listen, however strong and intense and new a certain temptation to sin or scenario might feel to you, do you believe this? Paul is saying here at its core, listen, it's actually not unique. It's not special enough to use as an excuse. You can't use it as an excuse. You can't blame your circumstances. When your circumstances are what you should have just expected from normal human life, you can't blame them. You can't always play the victim, right? Whenever you sin, listen, whenever you fall, you made a choice. Paul is pointing out. It didn't just sneak up on you and all of a sudden you're a victim of your circumstances. You can't play the victim whenever you fall into sin, especially sin that is just run-of-the-mill, par for the course, part and parcel of humanity. You can't do that. Paul says, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. He rips that excuse right from our lips. But notice, second, how Paul seeks to correct and confront the pride that not just blames our circumstances, and this is probably worse, though, but tends to blame God for not helping us when we need it. You ever do that? Maybe not directly, right? You're like, well, I'm not trying to blaspheme here. But you ever practically do that? It's easy to do, isn't it? Notice what he says at the end here. Here's how he corrects this mentality. Basically, Paul's going to say, look, it's not your circumstances, and it's not that you don't have what you need from the Lord. Why? Because, look, God is faithful. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. Do you believe that? But with the temptation will provide the way of escape also so that you will be able to endure. Here's how we sometimes don't believe that. No, Lord, you really stuck me in a pickle. That's how. We might not literally point our finger at him and say, you made me sin, but we'll say that, right? Well, he didn't take the desire away from me. He didn't just beam me up, Scotty, get me out of there, right? Have you ever felt like that before? That God just hung you out to dry? What are you implying by that? Have you ever been tempted to blame God for your failure because he didn't protect you or shield you from certain things that he knew that you were vulnerable to? Or you think back to your childhood days, you say, man, that happened to me, and how could God let that happen to me? And now it's resulted in this and this and this and this domino effect, and here I am, miserable life. What are you doing there? You say, after all, I prayed Matthew 6:13, don't lead us into temptation, Lord. Deliver me from evil. Here I am again. Whose fault is it that you failed? Paul gives us the right answer here. Notice, he says, it's yours. It's not God's. Why? Because God is faithful. Let's be clear about this. When you sin, he is not the unfaithful one. He is not the unfaithful party. In fact, 2 Timothy 2:13 tells us that even if we are faithless, he remains faithful. Aren't you thankful for that? Listen, the language of God's faithfulness reminds us of the picture that Paul had painted earlier in chapter 10. You remember of God as Israel's rock, right? Back in verses 1 through 5. He's a faithful, dependable, reliable, immovable refuge and structure. He was a sure and stable and faithful supply for his people Israel at every turn in the wilderness, even in supernatural ways, even when they were faithless. So while your temptations, here's the play on words even, you could say, while your temptations are merely human, God's provision is superhuman. God's faithfulness goes beyond human means even at times to supply us with what we need in whatever wilderness we find ourselves in. That's who God is. You can't blame him. But specifically, you say, well, how is God faithful when I find myself in the midst of a trying circumstance and temptation to sin? How is he faithful exactly in that moment then? Notice the rest of the passage. Here's how. Here's the answer. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also so that you will be able to endure it. In other words, here's how he's faithful. He never permits you to face a temptation that he doesn't also provide for you the ability to resist and a way to successfully escape that sin. That's what he's promising here. You see, Paul eliminates the common excuse here. Ever heard this? I just couldn't help myself. I mean, look, if you're a Christian, that's just not true. Because the first part of this, he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able to resist. That's just not true. One writer says, God reduces the tempting power so that it does not exceed our power to resist. God sets fixed bounds, even to the devil, beyond which temptation dare not go, as we see so clearly from the case of Job. Now, listen, I understand how you may not feel like this is the case, but Christian, it is. You have no idea what the Lord shields you from. And you say, but he allowed me to experience that. Well, yeah. Whose fault was it that you sinned? It's not his. But he also, notice, eliminates the excuse, this one, and I think this one is probably most common, but I had no choice. I had no other choice but to, right? I mean, I think sometimes we get in these situations that where we feel like the dilemma is, look, sinful choice here, everywhere I turn, man, I just had to choose the least of all evils, and I had no other choice but to sin. And Paul says, no, that's not true. No, there was an option where you could have honored the Lord, you just didn't want to do that one. We often say that and imagine that everywhere we turn, the only options left for us require us to compromise in some way. Just think about the Corinthians. Like, just put yourself in their shoes. Just let's go back into their context again. I mean, it's understandable, right, for them to feel like, Paul, you want us to be ostracized from society? I mean, look, we got to attend these temple feasts. Otherwise, I'm going to get fired from my job, right? I'm going to be labeled like some social outcast. I mean, after all, look, I'm not going to participate in the sacrifices. But I'm just going to go to the. You see how like we could make those dilemmas so easy in our minds and imagine, wow, you know, God will understand. Like I have to compromise here a little bit, right? One writer said, avoiding all overt associations with idolatry would invite hostility withdrawing from all idolatrous functions would scuttle any ambitions for social advancement, impair patron-client relations, fuel ostracism, and damage economic partnerships. You can't ask me to do that, Lord. It'd be easy to imagine to begin to justify, what choice do we have? I must be forced to dishonor Christ in the least way that I can. And Paul says, look, that's not true either, because notice the last part of this. With the temptation, he says, God will provide the way of escape also. You're never backed into a corner with no out. That's just what he says here. The verb here is to make a way out, right? To make an escape. To make a way out is the language. So you think about this. Listen, while we are making excuses, God is making an exit. And this is the promise that with every trying situation that God brings into our lives to test our faith by, he will always, Christian, take it to the bank, he will always bring with that temptation a way out. He will. You may not see it right away. It may not be the first thing your heart is drawn to because it's not comfortable, but it's there. I guarantee you, Paul says it's there. Every divine trial comes with a divine exit strategy. Every single one. That's what the passage teaches. God always provides an off-ramp. He never backs you in a corner so that everywhere you turn, your options are only and ever sin. There's never a situation in which you have no choice but to dishonor God. Listen, just do away with that lie. Notice the clarification at the end here, though. The exit strategy is not always out. Sometimes it's through. Paul says, so that you will be able to endure it. The verb endure here means to bury or to bear or to carry by being under something, especially some trial or difficulty or persecution or external pressure. You know Paul's saying here? Sometimes that's the way out, right? That's the way out of sin, but maybe not out of your difficulty. There's no such thing, Paul's saying here, as an unbearable temptation. And so one writer says, when we find ourselves in trials and temptations, we can know that he will not put us in a situation we cannot endure, but will make it possible for us to glorify him either in the situation or in thanksgiving for our escape from it. Either one of those. But here's the main point. Listen, you can't blame the Lord. Why? Because he has supplied. He is faithful. Christian, you cannot blame him for your failures and your fallings. Only the proud try to do that. So you think about, just listen, and we'll close here. The same thing's taught in James chapter 1, right? James would say, hey, look, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But James actually comes out and says it more directly. He says, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lusts. That's the problem. And when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. When sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. In other words, don't imagine God's the problem when it's yourself. Why, every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In other words, he's faithful. He's faithful even when we are not. He is not to blame when we fail. So, listen, let's pursue humility. I mean, if not just for this reason, that it'll help us battle sin better, right? It'll make us careful, and it'll cause us to own our sin and to face up to it, as opposed to make excuses for it. So, two major reasons why pride makes us vulnerable: because pride makes us careless, and because pride makes excuses. Let's do away with those and stand firm in faith against temptation. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for these reminders. What a practical passage this is for us. Lord, we pray that you'd make us humble people, that you would root out every form of pride in our hearts, for we know that it would make us vulnerable to any and every sin, even the most heinous ones we never imagined that we would fall into. Lord, help us to troubleshoot our hearts even. No doubt there are many here who have battled besetting sins. Sins that just, they don't seem to go away. They seem to always come back and trip us up. Father, perhaps it could be that we're proud. May we, Lord, confess that. Forgive us, God, for being overconfident. Forgive us for making excuses, for blame shifting, for at times even indicting you and your providence and your care and your sovereignty. Lord, we know that every difficulty you bring into our lives is meant for our good, the testing of our faith. So we want to strengthen our faith. We don't want to grow weak in it. Lord, help us, make us humble. We pray for your glory's sake. Amen.